From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Boogie Nights, we talk with Paul Thomas Anderson, the writer and director of this new film. Boogie Nights is about the X-rated film business of the late 70s and early 80s and how the industry was turned upside down by drugs and video. Burt Reynolds stars as a porn director. Mark Wahlberg plays his well-endowed leading man. Also today, a preview of a special series next week on All Things Considered about how we care for loved ones who are dying. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Wall Street is still volatile at this hour. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped nearly 100 points at the opening bell, but then it settled down and regained the loss. Currently, the Dow is up more than 6 points at 7,513. Traders reacted earlier to markets overseas, where there had been great volatility. The Hang Seng market in Hong Kong lost 3.7% today. The Japanese Nikkei average fell nearly 3%, and stock prices in London were off more than 2%. The Chinese government has signed a contract with Boeing in what's being called China's largest ever commercial aviation purchase. The agreement was timed by the Clinton administration and Boeing to coincide with a visit of China's president to the United States. NPR's Dave Mattingly reports.
China is purchasing 50 jets from Boeing at a cost of $3 billion. The order includes three dozen 737s and eight 777s. At a formal signing ceremony in Washington, Commerce Secretary William Daley said President Clinton's policy of engaging China in trade is beneficial to both countries.
From this sale, American companies will generate profits and therefore create jobs, while China will get some of the best aircraft money can buy.
The Commerce Department estimates China will spend $124 billion in the aerospace sector over the next 20 years. And Daley says the Boeing purchase may mark the start of stronger commercial ties between the two countries. Dave Mattingly, NPR News, Washington.
Chinese President Jiang Zemin went to Capitol Hill today, where he faced critical legislators. Jiang defended his country's policy on human rights by saying Chinese people enjoy a much better life now. Jurors in Boston continue to deliberate the fate of British au pair Louise Woodward, who's accused of murdering the 8-month-old infant in her charge. NPR's Tovia Smith reports from Boston.
Jurors began their day by reviewing a bit of testimony they had asked for last night. A court clerk read back the words of the pediatric brain surgeon who testified that a clearish fluid consistent with serum squirted from the brain of 8-month-old Matthew Eapen during emergency surgery on February 4th. Serum, jurors were also told, is a sign of an older injury. That testimony bolsters the defense theory that Matthew Eapen died from a weeks-old injury that went undetected until it re-bled on February 4th and not from a massive blow that day, as the prosecution charged. What may be making the decision hard for jurors is the fact that they have to choose between two extreme verdicts, a murder conviction or acquittal. It was the defense team, apparently confident of its case, that insisted the jury not be allowed to consider a compromise verdict of manslaughter. Tovia Smith, NPR News, Cambridge, Massachusetts.
On Wall Street, the Dow was up more than 6 points at 7,513. The Nasdaq is down 10 points at 1592. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the stock market is mixed and volatile trading, while volume is again very heavy. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports.
Investors continue to debate what effect the weakening economies of the Pacific Rim will have on U.S. companies. Shares in leading semiconductor maker Intel have fallen after UBS Securities reduced earnings forecast for the company based on expectations for slower growth in Asia. The Hong Kong stock market lost nearly 4% overnight after the credit rating firm Moody's lowered its rating on Hong Kong banks because of their high exposure to real estate loans. At the same time, the Brazilian stock market is being hard hit on speculation of a banking crisis in that country. This has also weakened shares in U.S. money center banks. I'm Doug Krisner.
Silicon Graphics says it will cut at least 700 jobs in a reorganization. Chairman and Chief Executive Ed McCracken is giving up his CEO title. Silicon expects to take a charge of about $50 million in the current quarter to pay for the restructuring. Silicon has faced trouble competing with other firms recently that make technical workstations like it does, especially those other programs that use a Microsoft program. Silicon only recently decided to adopt the Microsoft program. Waste Management Incorporated says Chairman Ronald LeMay and Senior Vice President and Chief Financial Officer John Sanford have resigned. LeMay has only been on the job since July. He's returning to Sprint Corporation, where he'll take up his old job as President and Chief Operating Officer. The departures of LeMay and Sanford come 2 weeks after they revealed the company's third quarter results were inflated by a one-time gain that was not disclosed at the time. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, putting a world of knowledge within your reach, with over 170 locations across America. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
My name is Jack.
Eddie Adams.
Eddie Adams from Torrance.
Yep.
Jack Warner, filmmaker.
Really?
Yeah. I make it. Adult films, exotic pictures.
That's Burt Reynolds and Mark Wahlberg in a scene from Boogie Nights, a new movie about a group of people who make porn films. Reynolds plays a director who's slightly more ambitious than the average X-rated director. He aspires to make movies that people will watch for the story as well as the sex. Mark Wahlberg plays the well-endowed teenager who, with the help of the director, becomes one of the biggest stars of adult films. Boogie Nights takes place from 1977 to 84 and chronicles how the business was turned upside down by cocaine and video. Boogie Nights shared the Toronto Film Festival's top award with LA Confidential. My guest is the screenwriter and director of Boogie Nights, Paul Thomas Anderson. Although he's only 27, this is his second feature film. His first, Hard Eight, was set in the world of casino gambling. Before our interview gets started, let me tell you that we will be talking about some adult subject matter. Anderson told me that he grew up in the San Fernando Valley in California, which he describes as a capital of the adult film business. He'd occasionally see mysterious film crews going in and out of houses, and he'd pass cinder block warehouses without signs, which he assumed were connected to the industry. I asked him if, as part of his research, he ever went to the set of an adult film.
I went after I'd written the first draft, and spent some time and hung around and just... it's a trip, you know. For the first 10 seconds, it's kind of shocking. But then after those 10 seconds, the shock sort of goes away and it's just work, you know. And you're kind of witnessing these people really trying to do good work, you know. And it's really not that different from a real film set, you know, where they're worried about the same things. Like, okay, is it in focus? Is the lighting okay? You know.
How's my hair?
You know, are we communicating what we want to communicate here, you know. And that's kind of interesting and wonderful, I think.
Boy, if you ever needed a metaphor to kind of hammer home film as voyeurism, being right on a porn set would have to be it.
Yes.
Now, you got Burt Reynolds to be in this movie, and it's an excellent performance, and everybody is saying so. He was a big film star in the 70s when this movie mm-hmm. is set. You grew up in the 70s. Did he mean much to you when you were growing up?
Yeah, he did. I mean, I can remember, you know, being, and I told him this, I said when I was 8 years old and I saw Hooper, the first thing I did was go home and sort of recreate the title sequence of Hooper, you know, in my own bedroom, like with like soccer pads, you know. I mean, the opening title sequence of Hooper, he's like putting on all these stuntmen pads, and I would sort of ran home to my bedroom and sort of recreated that title sequence with, and I told him, and I he was impressed. I think
was that
think
a good enough credential? Yeah,
yeah. I think that's why he's in the movie.
Well, was it hard to get him to be in it? I mean, this is your second feature length film to be released, but he probably didn't know you from a hole in the wall when you approached him.
He didn't, but, you know, the first time I met him was right after, so I sort of set up a screening of my first movie for him, and he watched it, and he had read Boogie Nights, so he knew what he was getting into, and we sat down, and it was kind of wonderful. And it was sort of the same thing as going to a porno set. You know, for the first 10 seconds, it's Burt Reynolds, oh my God, you know, but then it sort of quickly went away, and it was just an interesting guy to talk to, and that's kind of the way it was on the set, you know, is that ultimately he's just another actor who just wants to do good work, you know. And It's, but that's not to say that there weren't a couple times where, while we were editing the movie, it was actually, you know, he would turn his head in a certain way, or the light would catch him in a certain way, and I'd just sort of stop and say, "That's Burt Reynolds. How did Burt Reynolds get in this movie? What's happening here?"
Paul Thomas Anderson is my guest, and he wrote and directed the new film Boogie Nights. The Burt Reynolds character in your movie is a porn producer and director who wants to make movies that incorporate story into them, so people won't just watch the movie to see the sex scenes. They'll want to see what the outcome of the story is.
Right.
Is that based on a certain character or a certain type of trend in 70s porn?
Absolutely. That's something that you saw, I think, in 70s porn was more of an effort to create a genre, you know, to create a whole new sort of set of rules for these, you know, to take it out of sort of stag film status and make it, you know, a genre where you could tell a story and also have a movie that was basically a sex film. So I think Burt's character is kind of based on a lot of notions that flew around at that time, and there was a lot of people that really wanted to kind of try and dignify the industry at that time. Not to mention that Burt can also accurately reflect, I think, any so-called legitimate filmmaker's wishes, you know, which is, how do I make a good movie where, you know, I can keep people in the theater?
You obviously have a real affection for some of these characters. Did you know any of the people in the pornography industry, or have you since come to know them through the making of this movie?
I've since come to know them through the making of the movie. It's funny because when I first wrote the movie, I'd never been to a real porn set. Like I said, I'd only been sort of surrounded by it in a peripheral way, and all of my sort of knowledge was based on just sort of watching porno movies and seeing documentaries or reading a couple articles. And the actual research sort of in the field that I did was just to verify, well, is what I think the truth, you know? And then when I did meet some of the people in the industry, I kind of saw that my imagination wasn't really too far off from what the truth was. Well, actually, I should correct that. I would say that it was funnier and sadder than I thought it was going to be.
The young porn star in your movie is played by Mark Wahlberg. And in the movie, you know, his name is Eddie in the film, but he takes on the porn name Dirk Diggler. That's a name he imagines, you know, a porn star should have. How did you come up with that name, Dirk Diggler?
I have no idea, but I know that I still have the index card that where I wrote that name down when I was 17 years old in my bedroom. I really don't know. I have no idea. I mean, I think a good porn name has to have two G's in it.
Oh, that's, I knew that, important. Yeah. that's a kind of common assumption. Why? Why two G's?
I don't know. It just looks good and it sounds good for a good porn name. And you know, a K is pretty important, too. So, you know, I wish I really knew. But I it just kind of hit me like it hit him, I guess, like Dirk Diggler. Wow. That's my future.
There's a scene where Dirk Diggler pulls down his pants for the first time, and the crew of the porn movie sees how well endowed he is. Mm-hmm. And the camera pans the expression on each of their faces, and everybody has this absolutely fantastic look on their face.
Right.
And I'm wondering what the actors were really looking at when you shot those expressions.
You know, that's a wonderful question, and the answer is me. honestly, I think, and I remember it was the sound guy who said that was probably his single greatest experience on a film set, and I don't know what language I can use on the air, but I sat just off camera, because Mark and Julianne, you know, we weren't needed, they were just off camera. I sat off camera, and I said, okay, just look at me. And each reaction followed, as you see in the movie. So.
Well, you must have really showed them something to get those expressions. That's very,
you know,
funny.
I'm a method director. You know, I really.
The casting in your movie is really terrific. I mean, we've talked about Burt Reynolds and you know, Mark Wahlberg is very good. Julianne Moore, an actress I love, is just wonderful in the role of a porn star who's married to the director played by Burt Reynolds. And W.H. Macy plays an assistant director. Ricky Jay, the sleight of hand artist, you know, plays the cameraman. John C. Reilly, who had the starring role in your previous film, Heart 8, co-stars in this. He's terrific. What a find. I mean, do you have an approach to casting that you'd want to talk about? I just think you have a great eye for really good actors.
Yeah. Well, there's two approaches. First is most of those actors that you just mentioned are friends of mine.
Oh.
So I it's wonderful because I get to write parts for them. A, because they're my favorite actors. B, because they're my friends and we get to spend all summer shooting a movie together, you know. So it's just wonderful. And John Reilly and Phil Hoffman, Philip Baker Hall were all in my first movie. And it's a leg up, you know, to be able to go to an actor and say, well, what kind of part haven't you played before? What do you want to do in this one? And what can I write for you that you, you know, would really thrill you? And that's kind of fun. And you can also sort of factor in wonderful personal things about them that, you know, no one else knows, you know, and you can kind of write it in. And the wonderful thing is when they say, this character is nothing like me. And you kind of go, mm-hmm, sure it's not, you know. But anyway, and then, you know, with someone like Ricky Jay, there's a great advantage to, you know, going to make a movie is that you get to kind of meet people that you really want to meet. And for a long time, I wanted to meet Ricky Jay, and this was a way to meet him, to send him the script and go, I want you to be in this movie. Please, can I just hang out with you? Can I just be around you? and he said, okay. You know, with casting, it's funny because, you know, you mentioned Julianne Moore. I mean, she is someone that I had in mind when I wrote the part, but I didn't know her personally, you know. I knew her work. And so I wrote the part with her in mind and gave her the script and she went with it. I have a great casting director named Christine Sheeks, who really has wonderful instincts. She also cast my first movie. And not just in terms of these bigger parts, you know, but in terms of the smaller parts, you know, the thing you always look over is the person that says, you know, that comes on and says, like, more coffee, you know. You always kind of can look those over. And it's fun to... There are so many great actors out there. There really are. There are so many great actors that I really loved making a movie where there's 80 parts. You know, I mean, there's about 80 parts in this movie, and I got to cast 80 actors. And I just love watching them act, you know.
My guest is Paul Thomas Anderson, writer and director of the new film Boogie Nights. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Paul Thomas Anderson, writer and director of the new film Boogie Nights. Boogie Nights has an R rating, but
yeah.
It was originally, I think, an NC-17.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you decide to tone it down?
Well, that's a contractual thing. You know, when I first went to try and get money for this movie, I sat down with New Line and I said, so here's the deal. It's 3 hours long and it's going to be NC-17. And they said, can you pick one? And I said, okay, I'll pick one. I'll take it as a challenge to make this an R-rated movie, but it's going to be long, you know? Are you okay with that? And they said, fine. So contractually, you know, I was obligated to make an R. On our first submission, the film wasn't NC-17. You know, it had... No scene was taken out of the movie to get the R, but it was just a matter of sort of negotiating and trimming down on some of the sex. In the first sex scene that you see between Julianne and Mark... Just some of the shots were extended a bit more, so, you know, I don't know how graphic I can be here, but it basically was just shots of humping, you know, Mark on top of Julianne humping, and if you see his bare ass, and just sort of humping, if that goes on too long, that's something they say is a no-no. So you deal with the MPAA, and you kind of negotiate back and forth about what you can get away with and what you can't, at the end of the day, I'm really happy with where the movie is. You know, I think none of the stuff that they suggested, changing was stuff that affected the story, you know? And that was sort of the line that I had to draw was, well, you know, if we're just talking about shots of Mark's butt, you know, that's one thing. But the second this any of these suggestions affect the storytelling of the movie, we're going to have a problem. And it never did, you know, it never got there. And the funny thing is that I went back, I was going to do an unrated version for overseas or for Laserdisc, and I looked at it, and it's like 40 seconds worth of stuff, and I said, well, this is just silly, and I don't need it, and this is really the best version of the movie.
There's a scene where the Mark Wahlberg character comes home, and you could tell he's aroused by the bulge in his pants. Does that count as something that they wanted? Did you have to negotiate that with the board?
No, that wasn't one. They didn't have a problem with that. They had a problem with, like I said, humping, for how long humping goes on. They had a problem with humping and talking at the same time. And essentially it boiled down to when they said, so she's humping there and she's talking. Can you pick one? And I said, well, the talking is more important. So we just went and shot a shot of Nina Hartley. And I said, Nina, hump once, stop, say your lines, and we'll move on. And we did that and put it in and got the R.
Well, that sounds like a bad joke about not being able to chew gum and walk a straight line at the same time, doesn't it?
Yes. It's a similar thing.
Paul Thomas Anderson is my guest, director and writer of the new film Boogie Nights, and his earlier film is called Hard Eight. There's some great disco through the movie. I'm wondering what your feelings for that music is.
Well, I love all the music in the movie. It's sort of music that comes from my record collection, you know. The criterion for picking the music was it just has to be cool, you know. That was really the first thing. You know, it's nice if on the other hand it can work kind of thematically, or maybe lyrically there's something that happens that kind of complements what's happening in the movie. That can always be nice, you know. But just sort of music should just work on the vibe level first, you know. That's sort of the criterion that we used. And I'm very fond of that music.
The opening scene in your movie has behind it The Best of My Love by
right.
The Emotions. It's really, I mean, that record has to really help set the energy level for the movie. So it must have been really hard to narrow down, of all the records you could use, which one are you going to choose? How did you choose it?
You know what? That was not a tough choice. To me, there was only two songs sort of as choice for the opening, and it was either Best of My Love or Got to Be Real. And then Carlito's Way came out, and I saw that Got to Be Real was used pretty prominently, so it was very clear to me that The Emotions was the winner, you know. But I love that song. I think I love not only the sort of the lyrical value of the song, but just, like I said, the vibe of the song and the way that it starts to start, you know, in punctuation with the title coming on. It was really great.
Your movie is set in the 70s and early 80s. So, you know, part of the movie, you're really dealing with 70s fashions and 70s looks, whether mm-hmm. it's, you know, the stud look or the country and western dude look. My friend likes to call the 70s the decade that fashion forgot. It's the decade you came of age, and I figure when you were growing up, you thought that everybody always wore, you know, big hair and big sideburns and big collars and things
right,
like
right,
that.
Right.
Did you have fun with the clothes in the movie?
I did. I have to say the funny thing is that for as much focus as there is on the 70s stuff, I had more fun with the 80s stuff. I mean, because that was just a clearer kind of memory to me, is sort of moving into my adolescence and, you know, the sort of the wonderful trend of headbands and capizios and, you know, lots of zippers on everything, you know, was actually incredibly fun. The 70s stuff was great, you know, and the funny thing was is that my costume designer, Mark Bridges, actually, we had a hard time finding some of the stuff because, you know, the thrift stores are sort of bare, you know. I mean, 70s fashions are so in vogue now that the thrift stores are sort of all out of this stuff. So we really had to, it was sort of a massive, a much bigger treasure hunt than you might think to find some of these clothes. But the 80s clothes weren't hard to find. There's certainly a lot of headbands and and leg warmers out there.
Unwanted.
That's right.
Paul Thomas Anderson is my guest, writer and director of the new film Boogie Nights, about the pornography film industry from the mid-70s to the mid-80s. His previous film was called Hard Eight. Your first film, Hard Eight, was set primarily in Las Vegas, where, without saying too much about the story, a young guy in his 20s who's really kind of lost finds a father figure who's this kind of expert gambler and mm-hmm. is showing him the ropes in Vegas, showing him little tricks to get a free room, tricks to make people think that you're a real, like, high-stakes roller and a real winner and all of that. And I'm wondering how much you knew about Vegas when making that movie. About gambling, too.
I knew a lot. I'd spent a lot of time gambling, and I still like to gamble. Spent a lot of time in Vegas, and I really was just kind of in a time where I was obsessing about gambling. And I think in the same way I made a movie about the Valley, because I just wanted to stay in the Valley because that's where I lived at the time, I wanted to be able to walk to location. I made a movie in Reno just because I wanted to go gamble. You know, I really wanted to be there.
Why did you want to gamble?
I wanted to make money.
Did you make any?
No.
Did you lose a lot?
I lost a ton. You know, but
you know, I've said this before, but I can never understand why anybody who knows movies gambles, because in every gambling movie, the gambler always loses big in the end and destroys his life and mm-hmm. destroys his family. So, I mean, you always know what the outcome is going to be.
Exactly. But, you know, I think that's why you're there, is spending a year of your life trying to figure out why the hell am I doing this, you know, and hopefully you can get some answers from it.
Paul Thomas Anderson. He wrote and directed the new film Boogie Nights. We'll talk more in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Boogie Nights writer and director Paul Thomas Anderson. Also, next week, NPR begins a year-long series examining how we deal with death and how we care for the dying. We'll talk with its senior producer, Sean Collins. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Paul Thomas Anderson, writer and director of the new film Boogie Nights. It's about a group of people making X-rated movies in the 70s and 80s in the San Fernando Valley, where Anderson grew up. Boogie Nights is dedicated to your father, Ernie Anderson, who passed away earlier this year. And I think a lot of our listeners will know his voice, or knew his voice, primarily probably from his announcements on ABC television.
Yeah.
He was like the voice of ABC for a long time. I don't know if he was officially called that, but he did all those, you know, like coming up on the Love Boat kind of announcements. And he, you know, he had quite a voice. So tell me what it was like for you hearing, you know, your father's voice coming out of the TV all the time.
It was great. It was very cool. You know, he was a very interesting man. He had an interesting kind of job in that he didn't have to do anything, really. He'd get up for a couple hours, and he'd go into this studio down the street from where we lived, you know, in the valley, and he'd say a couple words, and then he'd come home, and you'd sort of wonder, like, what do you do? What's your job? He's like, I'm done. I don't know. You know, he just, and it was a great job, and I think he was really kind of happy that he didn't have to be involved with Hollywood or deal with, any kind of politics or anything, and he did it, and he did it better than anybody, and it was kind of a trip to hear him once in a while on the radio, or you'd be in the supermarket, and you'd hear, you know, a commercial on the PA there, and, but... It's a beautiful voice. I think we always knew when we were in trouble, in my house, because he would use the voice. You know, he would say, "Be home by 11," you know, "or I'm gonna kill you." You know,
it's a very authoritative voice.
Yes, you know, and you knew. Oh God, okay, he's using the voice. I gotta be home by 11.
And I think he hosted a horror show in Cleveland. This would have been before you were born.
Yeah.
A horror television show.
This is something that he did in the early 60s. It started his career. He's working at a local television station in Cleveland, and he created this character called Goulardi. And it was this incredibly odd, kind of avant-garde, freaky, beatnik thing where he would introduce these horror films, these sort of terrible horror films, and he would sort of do these little sort of vignettes before and during and kind of comment on how bad the films were, and he would sort of blow things up with firecrackers and just sort of be this all-around rebel, you know, that apparently a lot of people have responded to. I mean, people will come up to me and say, "Oh my God, you're Goulardi's son, and you have no idea what that did for me. It was the sort of biggest thing ever." And my dad used to tell me that he did this, you know, and I remember being like 13 or 14 and just thinking, you know, all right, well, what does this mean? You know, this isn't that big a deal. And we went to Cleveland and literally stepped off the plane, you know, people were all over him. It was like the Beatles had arrived or something. It was like, what is this, you know? But it was a very cool thing. I have a lot of the clips from that show, and very interesting. He was one of the first guys to sort of chroma key himself inside the movie, you know,
so he'd
be in there with the actors commenting on how bad the dialogue was or how bad the monster looked, you know, sort of saying, like, I can see the string, you know, I can see the string on the flying saucer, you know.
Would he act like the zombies were really chasing him?
No, well, he would do the exact opposite. He'd stop and say, look, this monster doesn't look real, and the zombie would kind of, like, run past him, you know. Very weird.
So did he help you get started when you started working in movies?
Not really. Unfortunately, like I said, is that he didn't have a lot of ties to the sort of the industry at all, you know? Mm-hmm. And I would sort of say, like, come on, Dad, who do you know? Help me out, you know? And he's like, I don't get involved in that, man, you know? And so unfortunately, there was this guy who was sort of in the industry but didn't know anyone. It was sort of like, you know, thanks for all your help, you know?
So what did you do to get started? What kind of television or movies did you work on before making your own?
I worked all around. I worked as a messenger for a long time for Messenger Service. I worked on a game show called the Quiz Kids Challenge, which was kind of fun. You know, three incredibly bright children versus three average adults, you know, who will win?
Did you have to write questions for them?
No, my job was to... they would go around to all over the country and videotape children, you know, at school, asking them a series of questions, and I would sort of edit down the top choices from each of the field trips, you know, and that was part of my job. To edit the quiz kids.
So you were like the Ed McMahon of precocious children.
Right. Exactly. I still have some of those tapes, actually. They're quite funny.
Maybe you can work them into a movie sometime.
I might.
Yeah. You, I think, worked at one of those Sundance workshops.
Mm-hmm.
Where, what, you get a fellowship or something to get to work on a movie?
It's the Sundance Filmmakers Lab, this run by a woman named Michelle Satter. You know, I had a short film that showed at the Sundance Film Festival in 92 or 93, and she came to me and said, you know, I love your short, and have you written a script? And I said, I had, and I'd written a Heart Eight, and I gave it to her, and she invited me to the lab, and I thought, well, I was a little bit skeptical. You know, I thought, am I going to be forced to buy Rhinestone from the Sundance store, you know, at gunpoint? And what it turned out to be was this wonderful, wonderful thing. I don't have any experience with film schools, really, and this, to me, is probably what film schools should be. The directing side of things, I brought up my two actors, John Reilly and Philip Baker Hall. We sort of picked three scenes from the script and rehearsed them and put them on videotape and then cut them together. And all the while, you're sort of surrounded by other directors, like John Schlesinger was there, and Frank Oz, and Michael Caton-Jones. And they're sort of guiding you and kind of giving you tips and talking about everything, just sort of talking about movies, you know. And then the screenwriting part happens, and you sit down with the script. And I met with Richard LeGravenaise and Todd Graff and Scott Frank. And, you know, they just sort of pick your script apart and kind of... You just get to sort of talk about movies for 2 weeks, and it's so wonderful, and it's so supportive, and you get to come out of there saying, I was at the Sundance Lab, which means something when you go to get financing for a movie. You know, people listen a little bit closer when it has the Sundance name attached to it. So,
mm-hmm. Boogie Nights has been really well reviewed, and I imagine it's going to be really popular. It's a great film. So that puts you in the position of being like one of the new hot filmmakers who's probably going to get a lot of offers from the big studios and stuff. And, you know, really that kind of thing could just be like the kiss of death, unfortunately, for a talented young filmmaker. Because sometimes like when big success strikes really soon, it's just kind of overwhelming and I don't know. But it's just easy to... lose track of your real vision, and I'm wondering, like, what mm-hmm. what your approach is going to be to, you know, kind of maintaining your sense of what you want to do.
I bought a set of horse blinders.
And, yeah.
I've put them on. I haven't put them on yet, because I'm still just trying to just sort of sit and enjoy what's going on. Because
yeah,
it's
sure.
Trying to find a weird balance of relaxing for 5 minutes, because I really did only finish the movie, you know, about a month and a half ago.
Wow.
I mean, we really kind of pushed it right up to the deadline. I want to just try and sit back and enjoy what's happening. I don't want to try and feel bad about it. I want to enjoy it, but then put my horse blinders on, you know, and because I have in my mind the next movie, the next couple movies that I want to make. So I can't imagine being swayed in any way from what that's going to be. The wonderful thing is that I have a luxury of having made a first movie that absolutely no one saw, you know. So it's not like, yes, I am young and this is only my second movie and this is a great success for me to have, but I've also got to go through 2 years of hell with my first movie and trying to get that scene and not having it happen, so.
Heart Eight?
I don't feel too spoiled, yeah, with Heart Eight.
Is that on video now?
It is now.
Good.
Yeah. I hope people will find it there.
So, my last question. Would you ever like to make a real porn movie?
Didn't I? It's 2.5 hours long. I mean, no, I don't think so. I don't think so. I think maybe Boogie Nights is my version of a porn movie.
Mm-hmm. Paul Thomas Anderson, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me and asking good questions.
Paul Thomas Anderson wrote and directed the new film, Boogie Nights. As you've probably heard by now, on Monday, Johnny Cash announced that he has Parkinson's disease. He'd been sick for a while, but the disease had progressed, forcing him to cancel the book tour for his new autobiography. He recorded a Fresh Air interview a few days before canceling the tour. We'll broadcast that interview next Tuesday. Here's a song from his latest CD, Unchained.
Take one fresh and tender kiss. Add one stolen night of bliss. One girl, one boy, some grief, some joy. Memories are made of this. Don't forget a small moonbeam. Fold it lightly with a dream. Your lips and mine to sip the wine. Memories are made of this. Then at the wedding bells, one house where lovers dwell, three little kids for the flavor. Stir carefully through the day, see how the flavor stays. These are the dreams that we will savor with his blessings from above. Serve it generously with love. One man, one wife, one love for life. Memories are made of this. Memories are made of this. Memories are made of this.
Coming up, a preview of an NPR series on death and dying. This is Fresh Air. Next week, All Things Considered will feature a series of reports on caring for the dying and the impact of death on loved ones and the larger community. It kicks off NPR's year-long series on death and dying. The senior producer of the series, Sean Collins, is going to give us a preview. We're going to start with an excerpt of a two-part documentary that Linda Wertheimer begins on Tuesday. It's about the final months in the life of Helen Payne. She was in her early 80s when she was diagnosed with leukemia last January. Payne was a very religious woman. She wanted to die at home, and her daughters pledged to do their best to honor that wish. Helen Payne had a pretty good, comfortable summer, but then she was hit by severe and mysterious pain. She had to be taken by ambulance to the hospital.
Dee Dee, Missy, and Glenda followed the ambulance to the hospital. Glenda Crabb questioned doctors and nurses at every phase of her mother's illness. She insisted always on knowing why various tests and procedures were being done, what the information might lead to.
We just need to clarify it so that she don't get, you know, because she requested not. But this is not an emergency anyway.
She saw to it that everyone who treated her mother understood no invasive procedures, no resuscitation, nothing beyond what's needed to make her comfortable. All that information was in Helen Payne's medical record, but whenever she was treated at the hospital, Glenda checked to see if it was on her hospital chart as well, and sometimes it wasn't. This time, no one could tell Glenda what was wrong. The leukemia was no worse, but her mother was suffering.
This first time I've had been sick.
What do you think about it?
Well, I just think it's something that I've got to go through with. I know we all got a trial, sickness we got to go through with before we go away. So I just feel like this is my time.
Do you think you feel resigned? I mean, you're just going to ride it out?
I'll ride it out. I will not resign. You let that devil knock me down. I'm just going to ride it out. I know the Lord knows all about me. So he said he wasn't going to put no more on us than we were able to bear. So I might as well bear it all night.
I don't know why Mama does that, though. Now, that kind of angers me. Like she thinks she's supposed to, you know, put up with it. And I tell her, Mom, you got to tell them you're in pain. You know, constant pain, hurting pain. I don't even know how she'd do it. I really don't. I think I've been cut my throat.
I just feel like this is my time to have this pain.
Helen's mysterious problem was a kind of warning for the family. They'd begun to relax, enjoying the summer, planning ways to spend more time with Helen. Now they began to be concerned that if something else happened, they would not be able to honor their promise to their mother to keep her comfortable and at home until she died.
Sean Collins, you know, what I think I find most interesting about the excerpt that we just heard is, you know, when you're dying and you're in pain, how much do you, like, resign yourself to pain or to death? And how much do you try to fight it and to stop the pain? The two different point of views that we heard represented by the dying mother and her daughter.
Well, I think your question's an interesting one because it conflates or maybe even confuses dying and being in pain. I think we all think of those two things sort of in the same breath. And a lot of the people that we met over the course of the last 10 months who work with the dying really are trying to expunge that idea from our head that dying does not have to involve being in pain.
Were there times when the family asked you to turn off the microphone so they could just have a totally private moment?
No. They never asked us to leave. They never asked us to turn anything off. Although I think we tried to be sensitive to some of those issues. We didn't want to wear out our welcome. And when we went to visit Helen, we would never stay for longer than an hour at a time. And in fact, we had decided, Linda Wertheimer and I had decided in advance that we would not ask to be there at the moment that Helen died. I felt strongly that that was too intrusive. And so I think we tried to protect their privacy, but at the same time, they were enormously generous to us. I mean, they let us spend a lot of time with Helen and a lot of time with the daughters.
What did you want to do a series about death and dying?
I wanted to do it because I think this is a topic that doesn't get discussed easily and doesn't get discussed enough. I went through the care of my mother when she was dying. And I remember coming back to work after being away from work for about 2 months and feeling a little guilty that I, when people asked me, you know, how are you doing or how was it, feeling a little guilty that my honest answer was it was some of the best time my family's ever spent together. And I had just never heard anyone say that before. The more reading I did, I realized that that is by no means a unique response. But that's part of the story that never gets told, that a terminal illness can actually draw a family together and that it can produce really remarkable interaction between children and their mother, in my case, or between siblings and between caregivers. And I wanted to make sure that we could tell that sort of story.
I'm wondering if doing this series affected your feelings at all about having a loved one die at home. One of the big questions in the Helen Payne story is, you know, what's it like when someone wants to die at home and the family carries out the wish? What are What are the emotional repercussions of that? What are the difficulties of that? What really brings the family together around that? Did any of what you found there change any of the thoughts that you had?
Yeah, it did. I came into this project thinking that hospice was a very good idea, and I still think it's a good idea. I think, you know, one doctor during the course of the series says to us that we now know definitively, based on more than 5 years worth of study, that the worst place to be when you're dying is in a hospital. I knew that instinctively. But with that said, and with all my sort of goodwill towards the movement towards hospice care and moving the event out of a hospital into the home, for instance, there's this interesting fact that comes up, and I think you see that a little bit with the Payne family. And that is, you know, medicine has been searching for language to describe the relationship between doctors and patients. And in the old days, the language was that of paternalism and professionalism. Your doctor was a professional, and he knew better, and you just did what your doctor told you to do. And then in recent years, you've seen a move towards autonomy, the autonomy of the patient to help make, you know, to be a participant in the decisions that are made about care. And especially with the care of dying people, you, with the use of advanced directives like living wills and durable powers of attorney, you find that family members are being given the proxy to make those decisions at the end of life. And I never really realized before how that could have an impact on grief.
What impact?
Well, I think people can be left feeling responsible for a decision, for an outcome, a bad outcome, that was going to happen anyway. You know, the mother was going to die, and now they might be asked by a junior medical officer, you know, do you want us to keep your mother alive or not? Now, that's an enormously painful decision to make, because, you know, no one wants to see someone go. No one wants to say goodbye. No one wants to witness a death. It's a painful, wrenching experience. But sometimes not continuing to treat that person might be the best decision. And for a family member to be asked to help make that decision, I think the whole notion of advanced directives and living wills and durable powers of attorney, those are all good things. But sometimes they can be used instead of the hard conversation between a physician and a family. And if it takes the place of that conversation, there can be a problem, I think, with grief.
My guest is Sean Collins, senior producer of NPR series on death and dying. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Sean Collins, senior producer of NPR's year-long series on death and dying. How many hours did you spend with the Payne family, and how caught up did you get with their loss?
I think we probably spent 45, 50 hours with them over the course of 6 months. And we did get caught up in their loss. It's hard to be a witness to that. And it's hard to see families struggle with decision-making and with, you know, are they doing the right thing? Helen was a great person and just very welcoming to us. But I think it was hard to watch the daughters, you know, and after the funeral, to see how complicated their grief was, and to see them struggle with whether or not they made the right decisions caring for her at home. That was very hard to watch.
Yeah, without saying what happens at the end of this, I will say it doesn't have a tidy ending where everybody learns their little life lesson and is a better person for it.
Funny, isn't it? I mean, that's how complicated it is. And I'm, you know, I hate to say this after the fact, but I'm actually happy that it isn't tidy, because it's not tidy. It's the fact that there are some ragged edges in that piece. I'm actually, frankly, very happy with, because I think it accurately portrays certainly what happened to Helen Payne, but it also accurately portrays what goes on, I think, a lot of the time. That what hospice can do and what good palliative care at the end of life can do is relieve some symptoms and some really distressing symptoms so that people have time to talk about things. That's what she saw with Helen Payne, is that she had time to talk with her daughters. And that's a gift that Helen gave her family that they will never be able to repay. I mean, that's an enormous gift.
Sean, give us a preview of what's coming up next week on the series The End of Life, Exploring Death in America, on All Things Considered.
Well, we try to lay some groundwork on Monday with a conversation with Eric Cassell and Christine Castle, both of whom are physicians, and with Jean Bernice, who is a hospice chaplain. We try to touch some of the neuralgic issues related to end-of-life care, some of the problems that have been identified by various folks in the field, and try to, you know, part of it is just glossary, try to give people some of the language that's going to be used in the next 4 days. And then Tuesday and Wednesday, we tell the story of Helen Payne and her family. And then on Thursday, we travel to western Montana. Howard Berkus goes out there, and we look at a program called the Missoula Demonstration Project, which is being run by Dr. Ira Byock. And he is really trying to change attitudes in one particular town, try to get people to talk about some of these issues more openly. And then on Friday, we end the week with a piece by Patty Naiman, who looks at palliative medicine, the type of medicine that's practiced by hospice physicians, a type of medicine that aims not to cure disease, but to make patients comfortable and to give them a sort of increased quality of life at the end of life. That type of medicine is a specialty in Britain and a couple other places, but it's not a specialty here. So we look at that debate about whether or not palliative care should be more widely available in the United States and whether medical students should be trained differently.
Well, Sean Collins, thank you for talking with us about the All Things Considered series, The End of Life. Thank you.
Terry, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Sean Collins is the senior producer of NPR's year-long series on death and dying, which begins Monday on All Things Considered. You can find a lot of related materials on their website at www.npr.org. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Roberta Shurrock, with Monique Nazareth and Alan Tu, who also directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Remy Martin, Cognac, France, since 1724. Information available, 800-678-REMY. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, we celebrate Halloween with horror film historian David Scall and horror writer and filmmaker Clive Barker. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.